Mr. Fine, Reel 5. We're talking about when you first met HMS Calder, so to speak. What were your first impressions of the ship when you were introduced to her?
My first impression was I thought it was rather small, but then again that was the nature of the ship. It was a small ship, only 1,300 tons and about 6 feet long. There was an awful lot of scurrying about, people running hither and there, getting things organised, because I think we had, well, I know we had a very limited time before we started going out and working the ship out. I think one of the first things I did was went and viewed the radar, because I think certainly I did. And I think we had one or two journeys to or from our buildings to see the ship and work on it before we actually moved in, moved on board. But once we were on board, then we obviously unloaded our kit bags, that was our lockers. And, the bunk there in tiers of three, with three lockers underneath, I had a mid bunk. Therefore, I had the mid locker, quite clearly remember it now. The lockers were quite roomy, they were on the deck, could get everything could be got in, there's no problem, didn't have any shortage of space to go store my personal things. I can quite clearly remember the commissioning ceremony, of which photographs are available if anybody wants to see.
Now, what do you remember of that?
Very little, except we were in tropical kit because it was summer. There were shorts and shorts and white hats. And as regards the actual service, I can't remember anything other. You know, I do remember seeing the very long commissioning pennant streaming in the wind. I quite clearly remember that. The actual service and all that was said, I can't remember a single word.
That was the 15th of July, 43.
If that been a, yes, that's quite probably what it would be about right, I think. But beyond that, to actually say I remember what was said, no, I cannot remember. It is a little bad, I think.
Now, what about your job, settling into you know, the radar?
Right. Obviously, I had some training on the set. It was rather interesting to actually go to see how it worked and how it operated. We had a pretty good idea. There is one thing that I'm interested in settling in. Being a small ship, the chart house, the radar office, the HFD office, HFDF office, the plotting table, and numerous other things such as that, was a very small, all-combined caboose. I would say maximum 12 foot square, probably not even 12 foot square. It was known as the control centre. It was just after the wheelhouse, right immediately under the bridge. And when I went in to the radar office, there was an officer there, a sub-lieutenant RN, I remember he was courteous and said, "Good morning, sir." And he wanted to know who I was, and I explained. And he explained to me that he was a navigating officer, also was in charge of signals and radar ratings would come under him. He requested to know what education I had, what school I'd been to. At that moment, I had no idea why he was asking me. I think a day or two later, he must have looked up my records, I can only assume, because he then said to me, "Do you know anything about charts?" And I suppose I must have said, "Well, they're obviously for navigational purposes in fairly near the coast." And I did actually like geography at school. And he said, well, from now on you will be navigator Joe. I was a little mystified as to what it meant. He explained to me that I would help him with the navigation in so much as that when he used the sextant and shot the sun, I would use the deck watch and take the time. That all chart corrections, which he got constantly from the Admiralty, would be done by me, which had to be done neatly with a little tiny, small little tiny pen with black Indian ink. Obviously, I'd have to be careful with the ink, especially when you'd see the ship was rolling. If that went over everything, you'd ruin the chart, so something you had to be careful with. I was not allowed to alter any charts that were, I think they were classified as secret and top secret. They would have been minefields. Although, one of my first jobs in any harbour we went into was to go ashore and get the chart corrections on anything relating to that, and usually pick up any signals. At a later date, the post, our ship's post was left, and they thought because I did go ashore first, before, you know, whenever we went to harbour, I would also be ship's postman. Was a very known in naval terms as a quiet number. You very often, especially when you're in the UK, did shopping, because you had to duck to town very often, various things, but did shopping for the crew. And you used to get back, usually, just before midday meal.
I'll come on to that, because that ship's postman thing's moving ahead. What did you think of Chris Easton? I presume that's who the navigation officer was.
That's the one you'll go and see, eventually. A very quiet man. Obviously, very professional. He was RN. I got my first impression was he was going to be a very hard disciplinarian, but very fair. And my first judgment was correct.
Now, what about the other officers? What impressions did you get of them? Perhaps the skipper would be a good one to think about.
Next to contact with him. I can remember him. I don't know if he ever said a word to me during the period he was skipper. The first lieutenant I did come in touch with, obviously, Lieutenant Davidson, RN, once again, a disciplinarian, but I found very fair. The other officers I virtually had only a passing contact with, because I came directly under Easton, and therefore they had no jurisdiction over me. It also presented a problem to my advantage, but not to the petty officers in charge of running the ship, that they couldn't get me for working parts of ship, because I was navigator's yeoman, and then subsequently ship's postman. So I was completely absolved of all unpleasant, dirty work on board the ship.
What about the
What
about the petty officers and the artificers and things like that? How did you get on with them? What did you think of them?
I had hardly any contact with them. The only person I had contact with other was the leading signal radar, a fellow called Jack Hall, who was from Newcastle.
What was he like?
No comment.
How many radar operatives were there?
Including Jack Hall, six of us. Of course, six. That's like two per watch, three watches. That's how it worked. You also did obviously plotting that when the time was right, in conjunction not only with the radar but also with the ASD, because the plot plane was connected to them. There was one point you might find an interesting fact. When we were on the ship in Boston, the Americans, as what you probably aware, are very security conscious. The radar in those days was very, very, very strictly confidential, to say the least. Because there was part of the equipment, was an enormous valve called the magnetron that the Americans had produced, and it was able to throw out a very narrow beam and therefore make the the direction in a very narrow beam of a, I think it was 2 centimeter beam, and therefore when you got a range, the bearing was very, very accurate. This was very, very top secret. And while the ship was in harbour, we had to, all the radar ratings had to do duty in the radar office, 4 hours on, 4 hours off, with the two doors, the door from the radar office onto the captain's sea cabin flat, and the door into the wheelhouse remained locked from the inside. And every midnight, if I remember rightly, there was a password. Whoever wished to come in had to give you the password, and you were armed with a 38 revolver in a webbing holster with 5 rounds in the 6 chambers, 1 chamber empty. You had to ask, if my memory serves me correctly, 3 times to the password, and the order was, if they didn't answer after you'd asked 3, on the 4th time you didn't ask, you fired through the lower part of the door. In other words, the object was to hit them in the legs. I'm pleased to say I never had to use any of the gun. Obviously, people could get to the wheelhouse and the bridge by going another way round, but they didn't have to come to the radar. So it was only people that really had to come to us that needed to know. And I'm almost sure the password used to change at midnight. That was all the time we were in harbour that we operated. I can remember very clearly there was an excellent canteen in the dock there, and one of our favourites, because it wasn't too far from the ship, used to go to this canteen and get wonderful lumps up and remember so of cherry pie and ice cream. I can still taste it now, it was fabulous, especially having been on rationing here, it was a wonderful boon. And it was a few cents, it didn't cost us very much.
Now, were you actually put into sea at all before you actually went off to thing? It's mentioned short sea trials.
Yes, that's right.
Do you remember anything about them?
No. Well, I remember we operated a set, we found it working satisfactorily. I think one or two adjustments had to be made. There was a radar and radio mechanical on board. His name was... I can't remember. He was a tall, slim Scotsman from Glasgow, very dark, spoke very quickly, and he'd been a schoolmaster in Sydney Street. He was a little older than us. I suppose he must have been 28 to 30. Being so dark, it was very difficult to ascertain his age. He kept very much to himself. I remember that. He didn't seem to be a very friendly man. Pleasant, but not close friendship.
And what exactly was he doing?
His job was to keep the set running, do servicing on it, and if I remember rightly, I think he also did servicing, I think, on the radio equipment, but that I'm not sure. Obviously, there were little terminals. I remember him taking a little emery paper and cleaning them. But in principle, as far as I can remember, the set ran very satisfactorily. It was a very good piece of equipment, vastly superior to any of the radar sets I've worked on in the UK and been trained on.
Now, the next thing was, they went to Charleston Dry Dock for degaussing.
Yes.
Do you remember that at all?
Yes, I do remember that, because the first time I ever been involved, I had to have degaussing explained to me.
Could you explain it to us, or what was going on?
Well, I think It was something to do with magnetic mines. And when you interviewed Don Ayers, he would tell you more about that than me, because this was a... It had to get the current running around the ship in one direction, if I remember correctly, but I could be wrong. It was mainly something to do with magnetic mines. It's say, the magnetic mines were attracted to the magnetism, and it's something to do with that. Not being a technical man...
What they did? Or?
Well, I don't know what they did. It was always something down in the hull of the ship.
Now, the next thing was they went off to St. George's Harbour, Bermuda.
Yes, and that's that I remember for a very good reason. It was our first trip to sea, and these captains of our frigate beings, call them what you will, could roll on a wet teacup. And we, I suppose, halfway down the coast of America, and we were a little way out, but not all that one, out of sight of America, ran into a hurricane. Well, for anybody who's been to sea will understand what I'm saying. You were thrown flat up against the bulkhead, and you could not move away from it for the force of gravity. The rolls from one extreme to the other were unbelievable. I'm sure, although I can't possibly remember it, I thought the ship was going to turn over. I have never before or since been in such, but that's not quite true. There was another incident in the Caribbean Sea in the Mediterranean where we had extremely bad same sort of thing. But the action of the ship rolling from one side to the other, and I think, and I cannot remember for sure, I think a roll from one side to the other and back again, which covered over an 80 degree arc, but I could be wrong, took 6 seconds. So anybody that understands what I'm saying will know it was horrific.
Were you seasick?
I've got to say, needs to say, I had 8 meals a day, 4 down and 4 up. And probably a lot more down, and more up than down. I do remember something down at Easton, as I said before, with the navigator officer, was more sick than any of us. He was really very ill, poor man. And a very close friend of mine called Arthur Kennedy, who I think I mentioned before, was the guy I met on the station the very day I went to join up. They were most terribly seasick. And being working closely with Easton, and you know, realizing how sick he was, and he used to be doing a four-room watch sometime, he was actually yellow. Doing his job, I realized he was very poorly. I used to go down to the galley to the officer's cook, fellow named Jack Richmond, who is still alive and a great friend of mine, and ask him to wrap up a couple of bits of dry toast in a serviette. And used to take him up to the eastern on the bridge and quietly pass him to him. Subsequently, many, many years later, and I'm talking over 50 years later, Easton met my wife, and he said to her, "Your husband helped to save my life," which was a nice way of saying thank you.
Now, there was problems with the compasses, both the compasses. Yes. Were you aware of that as you were?
I was not aware of it. That was Ron Ayers' thing. I know he was working with Easton as well. He probably knew. And I only heard subsequently there was a problem. You tended, I said, maybe with Marrow Miners or maybe Insula. You worked, you did your little job, you went back to your mess tent, you had a little food, you had to sleep, you may have had a game of cards or something, minor recreation, and back on watch. You tended to keep in your own little section with your own friends. That's what I found we did. We were in one of the foreign respects, and we had very, very little during the time it seemed to do with anybody aft.
Now, well, you went to St. George's Harbour, Bermuda.
Yeah.
To, was it HMS Malabar?
HMS Malabar. Working up charge. I think we were there 2 weeks. And if my memory serves me correctly, it was a rather amusing and terrifying incident, it was decided to exercise abandoned ship. All put on their life belts, and I, like many others, were told to jump over the side. And the water's nice and warm because it was Bermuda, Caribbean, or not Caribbean, but warm water. And they put scrambling nets over the side for us to get back on board. And they're all swimming around, everybody's very happy, having a laugh and a joke, splashing about in the water. When some wise fellow, I don't know who it was, shouted out, "I think there are barracudas about." Well, all I can remember is, before his voice had died away, I was through the water and up the scrambling nets and standing on the deck dripping wet, because I didn't want anything to be eaten. Quite clear. There is another personal thing that happened in Bermuda that I think you will find very interesting. I call it a coincidence to beat all coincidences. In the previous year, I had been on leave at home, and my mother, I was an only child, had said to me one morning, "What are you doing today?" I said, "Well, I'm going out early this evening up to town to meet somebody or other." So I said, "Well, if you're not doing anything very much, on your way out, would you go to the local town hall and pay the rates?" So I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I won't bother to come back." So I got washed, shaved and dressed, uniform. Went to the town hall, and when I finished, I came out, and I thought, "What am I going to do?" And I remembered that my old school, Kilburn Grammar School, was no more than a half a mile walk away. So I thought, "Well, there won't be any pupils there, but there'll probably be a few of the staff that I knew from the days when I attended school." And I walked up there, and I was given quite a good reception by the members of the staff that I knew, and obviously there were pupils there. I suppose fascinated the uniform. And I asked about this member of staff and that member of staff. And one of the members of the staff, who I remember particularly, was a man called A.J. Stewart, who'd been my history master, an excellent teacher. In fact, even today, and I mean quite sincerely, I still have a wonderful love of history because of his way of teaching. He was about 28 or 29, and he was also played left half or even the hockey. He introduced hockey to the school. I took an interest in it. I said it was good, but it wasn't too bad, and therefore I got even closer to this fellow, A.J. Stewart, because, one, as I say, I was interested in history, therefore, like all masters, they take a little more interest in a pupil that shows a little more interest in the subject, and the because of the hockey. And I, he said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Stewart is now a captain in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers," which of course is a regiment that no longer exists. And he was overseas. Now, I use that expression because I'm going to defeat the whole object of the story. When we got to Bermuda, and I thought, "Now, that name means a burden." And then I remembered, and they said, "That's where Stuart was." So we were getting ashore, and I thought, "Well, I'll go ashore on my own to Hamilton and look around to see if I could see any Royal Welsh Fusiliers. As you know, they had a little flash on the shoulder." Now, I couldn't see a soldier in sight, let alone a Royal Welsh Fusilier. Now, if any of you have been to Bermuda in recent years, the price of things there is astronomical. They were equally astronomical when I was there, and I was looking in cafes or little place to have a cup of tea or something, and the prices were way beyond me. So I found my way to the Church Army canteen and went in and had my tea and a bun. And then I had Jimmy Seeker, Wanted Nature. I went into the heads, and standing there at one of the tills was a Scots soldier, a real old Scot, because he was Glengarry. And I did, of course, I made a cardinal error. I asked him outright, which I should never have done, you know, more said, are there any Royal Welsh Fusiliers on the island? And to my amazement, he turned round and made girlish voice and said to me, hello, sailor, which of course I am. Was sort of taken back and I thought, well, it's my lucky day, my luck's changed at last. And he said, what do you want to know for when he became serious? So I told him the story, I'd been going to school over a year ago, and my history master had heard he was possibly on the island. And when he said to me, is his name A.J. Stewart? I was fainted with shock. I said, yeah. He said, I'm his batman. Now, isn't that the most extraordinary? There we are, 3,000 miles from home, a year later, and he was Stuart's batman. As I said, this is a coincidence of all coincidences. So he said, would you like to speak to him? I'd love to. So I'll get him on the phone. He got him on the Stuart on the phone, and then I got, oh, hello. He said, how are you? He was extremely pleased. He said, well, you guys are on just for sure. Oh, he said, how long? I said, I can't remember, but I think we had to be back at midnight, but I can't be sure. I don't think I had all my leave because I was still underway, he said. But I can't remember what time I had it. He said, would you like to come to have dinner? And I remember saying to him, well, I'm only in, it's the officer's mess, I'm only in Matlow's trouble here. He said, you're my guest. You're an old friend of mine. And he'd be delighted to see you. Sent a staff car for me. And there was me getting the staff car with a load of Jolly Jacks looking at me, feeling very important. And this officer's mess turned out to be the governor's house. I was introduced to the governor, and it appears Stuart was, military attaché and advisor to the governor of the island. I was asked, I feel very proud to sit next to the governor for dinner. Had a very pleasant evening. I assure you all that I did not let this sound down as a point. I thought many things were saying, you've got to behave yourself again, because the drinks were flowing like mad. And I had a little, but not an excessive amount. Was sent back in a staff car with the invitation to come tomorrow, tomorrow night if I could. Well, I was actually duty watch aboard the next night, but I thought, well, I'm sure I'll be able to get a sub. Well, next morning on the mess deck, I woke, got up, we were having breakfast, and I was telling all the chaps on the mess deck this story. Well, of course, there was a lot of weird remarks, and it was decided amongst all of them, and this is purely naval terminology, and only naval people understand this, that I must be first cousin to every comic singer in the Navy. I got myself here, and I went, and I got into town and sent the car for me. I had very nice dinner that night, and a few days later we sailed. I state this very clearly, I never saw Stuart again. In 1948, I'd long been involved, or was obviously over, I received from the school a letter inviting me to an old boys' dinner to meet to see all the old boys who survived the war. And they said in the letter they were opening an additional tablet to the First World War Memorial with all the names who had been lost in 39 to 45. We had our dinner.